The next paper that you have is agenda paper 1C, which is related to complaints about an alleged breach of due process. We received an anonymous complaint about due process on the 16th of October about the process followed on the amendments to IFRS 9, prepayment features with negative compensation. Section 8 of the due process handbook provides a detailed protocol for trustee action on perceived breaches of process, and we've taken the immediate steps required by that. The first of them was that the complaint should be, each complaint together with the name and contact details of the complainant should be posted on the website. But we did post this on the website on the 25th of October without the name and address. The next stage, which is the one we've reached now, is for the technical staff in response to the complaint to report, produce a report for the DPOC, which should be discussed at a meeting of the DPOC where the chair and or vice chair of the ISB are both present and both are today. And that is the detailed report that you have in front of you. Paragraph 8.4 stipulates you can ask for additional information from me before finalising response to the complainant. And then when there is an agreed response, that should be sent to the complainant and posted on the DPOC website. So you have a paper on this issue, which Henry will introduce. And the questions at this stage for you are whether you agree that the due process requirements were met, and the letter of the complainant should explain this. And I've also suggested that you should mandate Jim as the chair of the DPOC and me to draft a letter to the complainant once we're clear on what the decisions are.
Henry, please.
So thank you. So this moves into the paper now, 1C little 1. And this is the report that the staff have written in response to that complaint that we received. I think the essence of the complaint is that the board, in the complainant's view, attempted to establish a new IFRS requirement on the accounting for modification or exchanges of financial liabilities that don't result in due recognition through the paragraphs that the board added to the basis for conclusions on an otherwise unrelated amendment to IFRS 9 on those prepayable financial assets. And so in doing that, effectively, the complainant says that the board sidestepped the standard setting due process that's laid out in the due process handbook. So in response, we've laid the report, and it's really in two parts, because the first part lays out the process the interpretations committee and the board followed. And as we've already highlighted in our discussions, the interpretations committee were involved in this because it was originally a question to the interpretations committee. And then we've gone on to sort of analyze it and explain why we think that there has been no breach of due process. So firstly, perhaps just to touch on some of the process that was followed. Of course, some of this was explained to you at the last meeting, because we had had the slightly unusual situation that a question had come into the interpretations committee initially on modifications of exchanges of financial liabilities. Committee discussed the question last November, and the committee at that stage agreed on the accounting required by IFRS 9, but because it was a change in practice, they initially decided to develop a draft interpretation. And of course, under the due process handbook, that proposal for draft interpretation was considered then by the board, and the board didn't support a draft interpretation because, as Sue was just explaining a moment ago, in this context, the board just sort of said, well, that standard setting would essentially be used just to confirm the accounting that's already required by IFRS 9, and that would set an undesirable precedent. And so that led to the committee last March issuing a tentative agenda decision, and that tentative agenda decision explained that standard setting is not required to deal with the question, and also explained the relevant accounting in IFRS 9 for these modifications. That tentative agenda decision was exposed in the normal way, as for any tentative agenda decision, for 60 days for people to comment on. Now, since we last met and discussed this issue, the committee got the feedback on the tentative agenda decision, and they considered that feedback at their June meeting. And that feedback did not cause the committee to change its technical conclusions that it had set out in that tentative agenda decision. The committee continued to agree with its initial conclusion about the accounting required by IFRS 9. But in the light of the feedback and the comment letters, they referred the matter to the board. So in July, the board considered the feedback both from the comment letters on the tentative agenda decision and the feedback from the interpretations committee and reconfirmed its decision that standard setting is not required to address the accounting for these modifications of financial liabilities. But effectively, to address any uncertainty in practice and reduce diversity, the board decided to record that conclusions in the basis for conclusions on the IFRS 9 amendment that they were then finalising, and in doing so, confirm the accounting required by IFRS 9. And you can see in Appendix B of the paper those two paragraphs that were added to the basis for conclusions. Now, moving on in the paper to the analysis in paragraph 20, I just wanted to just highlight what I think are some of the key points here. And first of all, to highlight that I don't think the board has established any new requirements for the accounting for modifications of liabilities. It's not issued a standard, it's not issued an interpretation. I think it's also really important to realize that at all stages of the discussion, throughout the process, the board and the interpretations committee have agreed and have been clear about what IFRS 9 requires people to do in accounting for these transactions. So we don't think the board is establishing new requirements in the basis for conclusions. Instead, what those paragraphs in the basis for conclusions are doing is fundamentally they're actually just recording the board's conclusion that standard setting isn't required to address the question because the existing requirements in IFRS 9 already provide an adequate basis for companies to determine the appropriate accounting. And in recording that conclusion that standard setting is not required, the board has confirmed what the required accounting is by the existing requirements. And we think that's an appropriate use of a basis for conclusions because it's recording the board's rationale and its thinking for the decision that it reached not to do standard setting. And what I would just highlight is that actually it is not dissimilar to what the board did when they were doing the clarifications for the new revenue standard, which were issued in 2016. Because in that situation, various questions about how you apply the new revenue standard were referred to the board, and the board decided to do some standard setting for some, but for some other questions, the board decided standard setting was not appropriate, and so it recorded that conclusion in the basis for conclusions and at the same time essentially confirmed the accounting required by the new revenue standard. So we also think that the appropriate due process was followed because the board had not done standard setting. The committee's decision not to do standard setting, the committee's original decision not to do standard setting was exposed for 60 days, and all of the feedback that we received was thoroughly analysed and considered by both the committee and subsequently by the board. And I think the important point to note is, in spite of the feedback, neither the committee nor the board was minded to change their sort of technical conclusion about the requirements in IFRS 9. They didn't think any of that feedback effectively provided any new information above what they had initially considered in reaching their decisions. So we're always aware that the technical analysis might be unpopular and some would prefer IFRS 9 to be changed, but fundamentally we don't think that's a due process matter. So last thing really to highlight is that the board ultimately added those paragraphs to the basis of conclusions to bring visibility to this matter because it was important to address the uncertainty about the required accounting for these modifications in a timely manner, a point that the committee had initially raised. So I think those were the key points I wanted to highlight, obviously open to any questions that the committee has about our response to the complaint.
Is there anything else that you want to add to the summary that Henry has provided in terms of the responsibilities and duties of the DPOC? And then we'll have our discussion.
The question in front of you is, do you believe that due process has been followed? I have reviewed these papers, been through the issues with Henry and Cerna. My view is that they have. We will be reviewing, we propose to you that we should review the due process handbook next year. One of the issues that we could pick up is this interaction between the due process around interpretations and around standards. See whether what we have is fit for purpose. I suspect that we will conclude that it is, but that's something that I think we can usefully look at.
Okay, very good. We have Henry's summary, we have an outstanding paper, and we have Richard's input. Now, any questions or further clarifications?
Okay, sorry, clarification. The complaint comes from a whistleblower. Is the first time we see a complaint from the inside?
We don't know who it's from, so we can't say whether it's come from inside or not. We don't know who the complainant is, so we don't know whether it's someone from inside.
Okay.
It is anonymous.
Who would also hesitate to...
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they've branded that themselves as they identified themselves as a whistleblower, but it's not like a whistleblower to the classic way in which we use that term. They've given themselves that title. And I think, Richard, in the review of the due process handbook, I think it would be worthy of debating, should we as a committee, when we receive an anonymous complaint, should that be treated differently by the committee than we would treat it had the individual identified themselves? And so let's, as we review the handbook, let's ask ourselves that question and try to answer it.
It's a powerful point.
The other point that I just want to, in terms of transparency and getting all of the facts on the table for us to then consider whether we as a committee believe there's been any departure from the due process requirements for this particular issue. I just want to acknowledge that as the chairman of the Due Process Oversight Committee, this has been discussed with me multiple times as it has moved through the process, and as Henry also highlighted, it's come to us as a full committee. So very forthright, and the board has been clear in their judgment that standard setting is not required, that the change in practice is being dictated by the adoption of IFRS 9, not by two additional paragraphs being put into the basis for conclusions on this narrow scope amendment that has been debated. And so that's the conclusion of the board, and I just wanted to acknowledge that it's been discussed with me multiple times over the past 12 months, and I have not raised an issue or challenged the efficacy of the completeness of due process in those conversations. But comments, questions from any member of the committee? Please, Gil, help me with your first name.
Guillermo.
Guillermo, thank you very much.
Just a question. Why was it decided to have these two paragraphs in the basis for conclusions of a subject that seems unrelated to those two paragraphs? So why wasn't it published in some other way, which was not just the basis of conclusions for these particular prepayment features with negative compensation?
Sir, would you take that one, please?
Sure. It was really because the interpretation committee decided it didn't think it should issue an agenda decision. And so it asked the board to look at what the board wanted to do. And so given the tools at our disposal, the clearest one we had available was, particularly given the time frame and the fact that we wanted to address diversity and it's very close to the effective date of IFRS 9, the fact that we were already making an amendment to IFRS 9 gave us the best opportunity to address it quickly, to address diversity. As Henry said, it's consistent with what we've done in other circumstances. It's not completely unrelated because both of the amendments actually relate to how you do amortized cost accounting and the mechanics of that. So even though it's described as an other issue, it's related to the same topic. And also, it was because the strongest message that we got from the Interpretations Committee, even though they felt that the requirements were adequate already without doing standard setting, was that it was a change in practice and that they wanted us to do something which was as visible as possible. So we thought that the basis approach was a way of giving visibility to the issue.
Excellent, please.
make sure that also
Yeah, on that paragraph 8, there is a specific, is the board position typed in paragraph 1 of the due process handbook and comply with the minimum safeguards described in paragraph 3.43. That requires that any proposed, my question is this a wrong understanding of what is required of the process that should be followed? Or, because he seems to claim here that if there is going to be additional paragraphs in the due process, this is how it should have been done. There should have been consultation. Are we satisfied that we complied with the handbook and that this interpretation is not justified?
I would just add that I'd address in the report. Those paragraphs on the basis, those paragraphs in the due process handbook are laying out the process that needs to be followed when the board is actually doing standard things, so either changing the requirements or adding to those requirements. In this case, the board's decision fundamentally is not to do standard setting. There is no change being made to the standards. So therefore, some of these requirements that the complaint is referring to are not actually applicable.
We have to do that if we were changing the standard, and all we were doing was confirming what the standard already said.
But changing the paragraph in the basis of conclusion does not require this kind of process.
That's fine. Remember that the basis for conclusion is not actually the standard. It's not authoritative requirements. It's accompanying material to the standard.
Other questions?
Please. Just building on that, is there anything else on what can or cannot be in the basis of conclusions?
No, there's no specific requirements around what can be in the basis for conclusions. What it's used for in practice is, as the name would suggest, it's an explanation of what was behind the decisions the board made that have ended up in the front part of the standard.
When the board needs the basis.
I can say I just hope that this will remain a very unusual situation, because if the Interpretations Committee has come to the conclusion, the standards are clear, and you know, the standards are perfectly clear in this case. Normally, there would be an agenda decision taken which gives the visibility that the Interpretations Committee wanted. And now we were forced to look for a creative solution, which I believe is perfectly fine from a due process point of view, where it would have to just, well, let me just put it this way. I hope that this won't be repeated, this situation, because it was just very weird.
Very fair, Hans. Thank you for that comment. I don't see any other questions coming from members of the committee. Just in terms of, again, transparency, when I asked the firms, when I had the call with them earlier, these are the IFRS leaders of the six largest firms, if they viewed this as a departure from due process, and my summary of my conversation with them is they do not, and that they agree with the conclusion of the board that standard setting was not required. And then they also very quickly said diversity in practice would have been a much bigger problem than having a little bit of inelegance around the way in which this conclusion on how the standard is applied to these circumstances. You know, everybody with hindsight might want to do that differently when we originally issued IFRS 9, but the firms felt that allowing diversity in practice to exist and practice not to change related to this would have been a much bigger problem. So we need to then confirm whether we are comfortable that due process has been followed in this case, and that would then be communicated both A, on our website, and B, in a letter that we would be sending back to this Gmail box that this so-called IFRS whistleblower who submitted the complaint provided. But we would then be, as a committee, formally responding to them. But I just need to see where we are. Let me ask it this way. Is everyone comfortable with the staff recommendation, the quality of the paper we've received, we've heard from the members of the board? Is everyone comfortable that due process has been followed in this circumstance? Anyone depart from that conclusion? Okay, seeing them, we will have the letter then back to the complainant make that clear, that we as a committee are comfortable that due process has been followed. And what we're really saying is we're agreeing that the board, when it decides that standard setting isn't needed, there's not any due process for us to oversee in reality. We're not the standard setter, but I understand the logic and the way in which the board has responded, and they're not amending IFRS 9. They're in the basis of conclusion being clear on how IFRS 9 is applied to this fax pattern that has been described when this issue initially came up. So with that, Richard, anything further needed from the committee? And Richard and I will take the ball. Gilmer, well, please.
Jim, I'm wondering whether, given the importance of this issue, should we see the draft of the answer as a committee and have a few, just a couple of days to review it before it is published back in the website?
Totally agree. And we will make sure that what we'll do then mechanically is Richard and I will create a draft and we'll circulate it to the full committee and give you an opportunity to provide input prior to that being posted and prior to that being then sent back to the complainant. But that's a very good point. Thank you. That's much better. CB, please.
I had a slightly different view. If by definition the complainant is anonymous, what does it mean to be responding to an anonymous person? We should merely be stating our position on the website. And the whole world knows it. So this anonymous person will also know it. Do we have an obligation to respond to somebody who is anonymous?
The handbook says that we should respond to the complainant, and we do have an email address for that complainant, just don't know who lies behind it, and put the response on the website. I don't think we have the ability.
As we acknowledge when we review the handbook as part of this process, one of the things that we will look at is the complaint process and whether or not the way in which we handle anonymous complaints might be different than the way we would handle a complaint if the individual stood up and put their name with it. Okay, that's been helpful, and I appreciate the comments, and we will comply then with the next steps as we have agreed.